Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the elections in Austria that are too close to call, but could result in the election of a far-right candidate as the first head of state of an EU country. Christian Schuller, a reporter and correspondent in Austria who covers Eastern Europe for Austria's TV network ORF and previously reported from Turkey and Iran for ORF, joins us. We will discuss the rise of Norbert Hofer of the Freedom Party that has been propelled by anxiety and a resurgent nativism as a result of the influx of refugees from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. We will discuss recent incidents of cultural clashes between Austrians and immigrants from the Middle East and whether the Green Party candidate and economics professor can squeak by with mail-in ballots that will decide this 50-50 election. Then we will speak with Sean Wilentz, a professor of American history at Princeton University and author of The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. We will discuss the historical record of nativism in the United States and how much its revival with Donald Trump's candidacy is repeating the past anti-immigration, anti-immigrant, know-nothing movement, and whether the divisions that Donald Trump is creating within the Republican Party will lead to a split in the GOP. We will also discuss Sean Wilentz's latest article at the New York Times, If Trump Breaks Up the GOP, It Won't Be a First. Then finally, we'll examine the assassination by drone of the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Mansour, and whether it will have any impact on the military situation in Afghanistan since Mullah Mansour was opposed to any compromise, and since Mullah Mansour was opposed to any compromise or peace agreement, will his death open the way for peace talks between the government in Kabul and the Taliban? Chris Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program, joins us to discuss the extent to which Pakistan may have helped in targeting the drone and what the rise in the influence and military clout of the Pakistani-supported Haqqani network means for the future of Afghanistan. And joining us now from Austria is Christian Schuller, who's a reporter and correspondent who covers Eastern Europe for ORF, the Austrian TV network, and previously he reported from Turkey and Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christian Schuller.
Hello.
So, Christian, what's the latest? You've got a real nail-biter there. This, of course, is the second round in the presidential elections. The first two candidates from the last one, Norbert Hofer and Alexander Van der Bellen, are running against each other. Hofer won 35% of the vote in the first round. And I think the other candidate, the Green Party candidate, I think won about 20% or something. So now it's at 50-50, and I take it that the mail-in ballots are going to decide. Is that the situation?
Exactly. It's true. There has been a lot of suspense today because the two candidates are only separated by a few thousand votes. And those votes cast by mail, around 900,000 votes, 12% of the electorate, will be counted tomorrow. So only tomorrow we will know whether the right-wing candidate has won or whether it's this other economics professor backed by the Green Party. But even if the right-wing candidate doesn't win by a few thousand votes, but the result shows that half of the Austrian population voted for an extreme right-wing candidate, and this is important.
So already people, of course, are making comparisons with the rise of Donald Trump and his anti-immigrant popularity in the resurgence of nativism here in the United States. So, and of course, most analysts point to the influx of refugees from the Middle East last summer. Of course, a huge number came in. I believe 90,000 people have claimed asylum in Austria last year, which is 1% of the country's population. So how much is that a part of this mixture, or did this provoke this resurgence of the right wing?
Well, Jan, it's part of it, but it's not the only reason, because the rise of the right wing party started well before this, before last year, before this refugee crisis. Of course, being anti-immigration is one of their main topics, but I think the one of the reasons of their popularity is that they are seeking very, very simplistic and simple answers to very complicated questions like unemployment, like European integration, and with their stance of giving frustrated people fearing unemployment, fearing for their jobs, the feeling of being strong again when they vote for a strong man, this works, unfortunately.
Well, boy, what you're saying has echoes of what's happening over here. I mean, you have in Donald Trump, exactly. I mean, how much are Norbert Hofer and Donald Trump alike? I mean, Hofer, I believe, is a soft-spoken, I think he's quite charismatic, exactly. And he may not have the same resume on television as Donald Trump, who's a practiced and seasoned reality show star. But he's also a gun enthusiast. Donald Trump just over the weekend spoke to the NRA and promised to undo all gun control in this country. So are there comparisons?
Yes, indeed. Not in the personality, because as you said, Norbert Hofer is even called the smiling face of the right party, of the rightist party. But so he's not, he's very soft-spoken and so, but he is just one of the figures in this party. The strong man of the party, Heinz Christian Strache, is really the kind of right-wing leader that you would expect, trying to divide society, using hate speech against immigrants, against the left, and everybody is leftist who is not in favor of this nationalist politics.
Again, I'm speaking with Christian Schuller, who is a reporter and a correspondent in Austria, who covers Eastern Europe for the Austrian TV network ORF, and previously he reported from Turkey and Iran for ORF. And the elections today in Austria, the presidential elections, are literally tied 50-50. They won't be decided till tomorrow, and they'll be decided largely by the counting of the mail-in ballots. So let's talk about some of the incidents that have recently indicated, shall we say, at the very least, a cultural clash between the immigrants recently arrived from the Middle East and Austrian population. There was, of course, a much publicized rape of a grandmother by an Afghan. Have those have galvanized? Do you have a kind of a tabloid press there as well, since Donald Trump is the champion of the tabloid press over here?
Yes, the tabloid press is dominating Austrian politics, which is a very unique phenomenon, I think, for a European democracy. But we can see that even the government people are trying to make a lot of deals and compromises with the chiefs of the tabloid press, because they fear that the tabloid press is kind of supporting the right-wing parties, and all the politics of the last years has been driven by this fear, which is in a kind of way ironic, because the government parties, the Social Democratic and the Conservative Party, have tried to imitate politics of the right-wing party in order to steal votes from them, but it did never work. To the contrary, so this coalition of tabloid parties and right-wing parties gets stronger and stronger, while the traditional parties in Austria are completely losing ground. So we had, for instance, this time a presidential election where there was no candidate of the government parties in the second round. So it's like if you had elections in America with no candidate either from the Democratic or the Republican Party. It shows that the political system in Austria is changing very quickly, and the traditional structures of politics are kind of disappearing, and now new radical movements are trying to fill the void.
Well, that's not entirely unlike what's happening here, Christian Schuller, in as much as Bernie Sanders is a socialist, not a Democrat, even though he's running as a Democrat. And Donald Trump is hardly a Republican. You've got the Republican establishment doing everything they can to stop him. And there's even talk of a third party splitting within the Republican Party itself. So there's elements of that happening here. But it would seem to me that what you're talking about, the breakdown of the traditional parties, and most of European, Western European politics have been dominated by the conservatives versus the socialists, which is kind of like the Republicans versus the Democrats here. They've sort of been, they've had this duopoly of power forever in most Western European countries. But now you've got, with the Brexit in England, you've got the possibility of the rise of nativism there with the UKIP, and that may have a contagious effect on the EU with Le Pen's rise in France, the far-right one-wing party that did very well in the last elections. And in general, you've got right-wing populist movements joining government coalitions in Finland and Norway. And in Eastern Europe, which is what you cover for Austrian television, you've got Viktor Orban in Hungary. You've got a right-wing populist Eurosceptic anti-immigrant parties in Poland, and you've got a neo-fascist party in Slovakia.
Yes, I mean, many people compare what's going on in Austria right now exactly with developments, let's say, in Hungary or Poland or Slovakia. What struck me when I was in Hungary just a few weeks ago is that the majority of the population is supporting this authoritarian, very right-wing government. And the fact is that with his support, you can even, what Viktor Orban does basically, he can change the rules of the system. He can change the rules of democracy, because it appears that the foundations of our democracy are not necessarily backed by the majority of the people. If you ask them, is free press really that important for you? Is the separation of powers really that important for you? Or and the other questions that are more important, so the majority of the population in Hungary, it seems, decided no, freedom of the press is not that important. The independence of the judiciary is not that important. We want more jobs, that's it. And with this kind of populism and rhetoric, you can really change the rules of a system very quickly. And people in Austria also fear that in a few years this could happen in Austria or in other places.
Well, of course, the difference being that Orban and Hungary were quite hostile to the influx of refugees from the Middle East. They put up wire fence barriers, etc., whereas Austria was generous, and Germany in particular became the destination for about a million people, didn't it? I mean, so...
Yes, but it didn't change. As I said at the beginning, of course, it gave more power to the, or more votes to the right-wing parties, this refugee crisis and the results of it. But it was not, it's not, by far not the only reason. And even without those 90,000 refugees, we would also have a very strong rightist party and possibly also have Mr. Hofer being elected or nearly elected as president, because the rise of the right wing was a process for the last 10 years.
So it's not, so in effect, you're saying that the immigrant influx maybe is the straw that broke the camel's back, as the saying goes, that there was already a distrust and a dislike for politics as usual, which is very much, again, what is propelling the Trump phenomenon here in the United States. So,
politics as usual, and also the European Union. So the traditional parties, conservatives and social democrats, are paying the price for all the problems of the European Union. People who think that their personal problem is caused by the European Union, they think they have to punish either the Social Democrats or Conservative Party for that.
And the dislike of the EU is what? That a bunch of bureaucrats in Brussels are taking away their sovereignty?
Well, symbolically, yes, but in fact, of course, the European Union became a little bit of a game for national politics, because you can, whenever there's something going wrong in a country, you can say, well, it's not our fault, it's the guys in Brussels who are spoiling the game. And although everybody knows that the European Union cannot take decisions so easily, because 28 countries have to agree on something, so it makes the process very slow. And for everything that doesn't go well in a country like Austria, so populist politicians will say, yes, that's because we cannot decide for ourselves. We're part of this European Union, which works so slowly and so on. And people like to hate somebody. And if you tell them you can hate the European Union, they will do it. So they do it in Hungary. They do it also in Austria.
So do you foresee then, or do you think that the centre will hold, as they say, in terms of the EU, with the British Brexit vote on the June the 23rd, if that goes against the government, which Cameron himself is responsible for even allowing this ridiculous referendum to happen in the first place, but it can't be stopped. And if it goes against Cameron, most analysts think that it could have a contagious effect on the EU, France with the right wing getting aid and comfort from it, and eventually this whole EU Eurozone experiment will unravel. Do you see that as a possibility?
It's quite possible, yeah. It's quite possible. It's something that many people here are concerned about, We will see, of course, after this referendum in Britain, but I think that this development of the Brexit hanging over Europe has done a lot of damage to the authority of the European Union, the political authority of it, to the image of it, and this, of course, has been used by the right wing parties, and this process. Will continue for a certain time as long as we have not solved the results of the economic crisis.
Well, just in closing, also it would seem that given how close this election is for the head of state, even though it's a ceremonial position, it's still an important position. Yeah. But the fact that this Freedom Party has risen so quickly, what you're saying to us is that even if Hofer's Freedom Party loses by a fraction of a percent, that doesn't mean that these people are going away, and they represent half of the country. So already it's quite a phenomenon.
Yeah. They represent half of the country, and we will see the analysis tomorrow. But you can say that half of the voters of the Social Democratic Party, half of the voters of the Conservative Party, had in this election voted for the right-wing candidate, which should be an alarm for the leadership of those parties.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Christian Schuller.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Christian Schuller, who is a reporter and correspondent based in Austria, where he covers Eastern Europe for ORTF, the Austrian TV network. And previous to that, he reported from Turkey and Iran for Austria's TV network, ORF. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Princeton historian Sean Wilentz about his article in the New York Times, "If Trump Breaks Up the GOP, It Won't Be a First."
Well, I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
Yes.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sean Willens, who is a professor of American history at Princeton University, the author of The Rise of the American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, and his latest, The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. He also has an article at the New York Times, If Trump Breaks Up the GOP, It Won't Be the First. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Willens.
Great to be here, Ian.
And obviously there have been periods in America's history that do reflect the current situation, particularly, as you note in your article, in the early 1850s, when the Whigs broke up and the American Party, as otherwise known as the Know-Nothings, emerged. But of course, what resonates in terms of history with the Know-Nothings was that they were an anti-immigrant nativist party, and we certainly have that reflected in the rise of Donald Trump and the capture of the Republican Party by the nativist Tea Party wing.
Yeah, well, I mean, nativism has been a part of American politics from the start. In 1800, when the Federalist Party broke up, it was going to disappear 15 years later, but nativism was very much a part of it. The Alien and Sedition Act, trying to, attack naturalized immigrants and unnaturalized immigrants, rather. So it's been there, and it's back again. And it seems always to be part of or to precede the crack-up of a major party.
So there, of course, been up until a few days ago, there was an overt effort to form a third party on the Republican side, mostly, I think, generated by Mitt Romney. And it doesn't look like he's gotten much support for the simple reason that the Republicans understand mathematics and they don't want the vote split. That's not to say that they're happy with the situation, and the big donors are extremely unhappy. So why do you think it's possible that the party could break up?
Well, I don't know that it's going to break up. We're going to see that. But what's happening is that there's a very deep division. And the fact that Romney's still on board, or for that matter, Jeb Bush or the Bush family, important elements of what was the Republican establishment are not going along with it. We'll see how much it divides. They could hold together, but that doesn't solve their problem. The problem is that there's been a breakup of what had been the Reagan coalition of small business, small government conservatives with kind of a working class resentment. And that has really come unglued. That has really come apart. And I don't see who can put that back together again. It may be that Trump and his followers take over the Republican Party. That would be a very different party than what Ronald Reagan's party had been. If they don't, and if they don't succeed in November, well, then there's going to be a huge fight in the Republican Party between all sorts of wings. I mean, there's the Trump wing, there's the Cruz wing, and there are the more established moderate types, if you want to call them moderate conservatives. So I don't think that the fact that people are drifting on board now necessarily solve their problems for them.
Is there an analogy then, Sean Willens, in terms of history with the Know-Nothing movement, given their aggressive anti-intellectualism, the very notion that they would not identify who they were and what they stood for, thus the phrase Know-Nothing, and the extent to which, for example, Donald Trump said he loves the poorly educated voters. Is this a crisis in American education as it's much a crisis in American politics?
I don't think it's had so much to do with the American educational system. I think it has to do with resentment. And, what the Know-Nothings and the Trumpites have in common, above all, is an idea that their country is being taken away from them, right? That there's something lost. We have to make America great again because it's being taken away from them by other people. In the case of the Know-Nothings in the 1850s, it was about primarily Catholics, Irish Catholics, German Catholics, who are going to degrade degraded immigrants who are going to take the country over. Now we're talking about different kinds of immigrants, but again, it's an idea that these people out there, and it's more than just immigrants, by the way, but these people out there are undoing a great America that we have to recapture. That kind of resentment is what they really have in common. The question of low education, I mean, it tends to be a working class phenomenon, so that you found that in the 1850s as well. There was a great deal of support from, lower middle class, upper working class types who were feeling as if the immigrants were taking their jobs then. That's in common now. And I think it has more to do with economics than it has to do with education.
Well, the reason I bring up education is that we're in a fact-free zone. The facts are so manifestly clear that Donald Trump is unsuited for the presidency, and that you can rattle off all kinds of rational, factual information about why he's unqualified, and not the least of which is what he said, and it's clear that he will say anything to anybody depending upon the moment. So it's a time when, as far, you know, unfortunately, the Democrats have always had this problem that they believe in the 18th century age of reason, that if you come up with the best argument, you win the day. We know that that's not working. But on the other hand, how do you marshal the facts against Donald Trump?
Well, I don't know that you do. I mean, not with his supporters in any case. Look, Donald Trump is the latest devolution in American politics. Donald Trump is the style of a reality show champion. He's doing everything that someone who throws everybody else off the island does. He's doing exactly what he did when he was firing people on The Apprentice. That's his style. It's about style and narrative more than it is about facts. He's captured the anger and the alienation of people, but you know, he hasn't done so in large in fact. He's done so with gestures, with emotions, with outrage. The more outrageous, the better. That is his style. Now, will you be able to puncture that with facts? Yes, but you also have to puncture it with a different vision of America, a different vision of a country that is not being taken away, and a different vision of the future, and that's what the Democrats have to portray. If you try to get into a debate with Donald Trump about the facts, you're not going to win over certainly his people, and you're not ultimately going to be able to provide, I think, what the electorate wants, which is something other than Donald Trump that's going to get us out of the difficult situations we're in now. But it is fact-free. It is. That's all very true. And I just don't know that. I think that Trump is exploiting that. He knows where the culture has gone, and he's making the most of it.
So, in terms of the disquiet on the part of the Republicans, it's quite manifest with this Stop Trump movement, Romney's efforts, the big donors not wanting to pony up, etc. That's all very clear. At the very moment when it's clear that the Republicans and the Republican establishment are appalled by Trump, Hillary Clinton goes out and says she can't wait to debate him, which is, to me, the most boneheaded thing I've ever heard. It's like what George W. Bush did with bin Laden. He said, you know, he put him as an equal player on the global stage with the global war on terror, as though he were the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler. And it seems to me that she's not getting good advice, that the only way to beat Trump is to essentially marginalize him as opposed to dignify him by making him an equal player. And as we know, the Democrats are divided. And Bernie Sanders is trying to get the nomination, even though mathematically it seems uncertain and unlikely. So you have this weird situation where you could end up with a fratricide on the Democratic side where the candidate who's opposed to the billionaires ends up helping elect a billionaire.
Well, let me correct a few things. First of all, the Democrats are not divided. Okay, Bernie Sanders, who is a nominal Democrat, has aroused a great constituency, but the party itself is not divided in the way that the Republicans are. You know, the Republicans, you have big donors, you have all those people, the Bushes, the Romneys, et cetera, who are very much at the heart of the party. They're saying no. The Democratic Party, is pretty united around Hillary Clinton right now. You're not going to find the same kind of fissures. To be sure, there's anger and there's dissension inside the Democratic primaries, but the party is not fundamentally as divided as the Republicans are. What we'll see, you know, when we get to the California and New Jersey primaries all the way to the 14th in D.C., we'll see what happens thereafter. There are plenty of people on the Democratic side who are, would appeal to Sanders' voters. Sanders would be one of them, and we'll see if he will unite with them. But there are plenty of others, including Elizabeth Warren. We'll see. I mean, Elizabeth Warren has been spending her time attacking Donald Trump, which Hillary Clinton is finding it difficult to do because she has to run against Bernie. But I don't see the division as being anywhere near as severe. Secondly, in a debate, I'd like Hillary Clinton's chances in a debate against Donald Trump any day. It's a different kind of thing when you're running for president than when you're running for the Republican nomination. And it's going to be a very different kind of scene. She's a very good debater. She's done very well in her debates with Sanders. So I'm not concerned about all of that happening. I think things could work out very, very well. I'm not saying they will work out very well, but I'm not sitting around worrying about Donald Trump getting to the presidency.
And do you think that the press, who have enabled Donald Trump with about $2 billion worth of free advertising, since he knows how to play them, Are they going to show some social responsibility? I mean, the more that he becomes, as you can notice, Sean Walensky, the Republicans are all rallying around him. They're all those that have been grumbling and saying the sky is falling are now enthusiastically embracing him. So I don't think
Some of them enthusiastically, some of them not. I mean, John McCain is not exactly an enthusiastic supporter. But he's got an election to win in Arizona, so he has to support the candidate. But we'll see how the campaign develops, how strong that drift actually amounts to.
Right.
If Newt Gingrich, sure, you want to be vice president, but I don't necessarily see the wave. The drift that's going on now is perfectly understandable because they're trying to hold the party together to get through the election. But how much that's going to translate into strong support by the party, apart from Reince Priebus, for the party is unclear. It's also unclear to me that, in fact, the party and the Trump people can actually get together. I'm not talking about, the politicians whose names you know. I'm talking about the party apparatus. Mm-hmm. I mean, Trump has his own apparatus, but it's really unclear what that is. Can he merge that with the Republican Party? Can Roger Stone and Paul Manafort actually, they're going to be very distrustful of what the Republican Party is, but they always have been.
Right.
So it's unclear to me that they're going, even as a matter of logistics, put a campaign together. We'll see.
Right.
But it's not altogether clear to me that they're managing to do so.
Well, the point I wanted to make, though, was that at the end of the day, I think they will rally around him. And the question would be, both with the Republicans themselves, those that criticized him initially and then embraced him subsequently, and the press that built him up, all those ugly things that Trump said, will they be forgotten and forgiven? Or will there be some more scrutiny, do you think?
Well, I mean, I can't answer for the press. The press is, Trump has manipulated the press to a fairly well, and he's very good at it, and he knows how to do it. Whether that stuff won't come back to haunt him or will be forgotten, that'll mean part of it. Depend on what the Clinton campaign can manage to do, and how they will deal with the press. I don't think that Donald Trump is a master of the universe in this respect. I think that what can be done can be undone. It's true that the ratings have been great. Some of the media people have been quite cynical about this. Donald Trump is good for ratings, so we're going to cover him. Whether that will continue into a general election, I'm by no means persuaded that it will.
And Sean Willis, when you said that you're not worried about the Democrats, even though there is quite a battle going on between the Sanders campaign and the DNC, it's pretty clear that Debbie Wasserman Schultz has always been in the bag for Hillary Clinton, and she's extremely unpopular, at least with the grassroots Democrats. Do you foresee, even though you think that at the end of the day, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are going to work things out, That doesn't mean their constituents are, particularly those that have supported Bernie. They're pretty angry. They think the system is rigged against him. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz is kind of becoming the poster girl for all that's wrong with the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's the way it is now. I don't think that that's necessarily going to last. I don't think it will last, actually. I think that people are angry. People are always angry at the end of it, and for good reasons. Their candidate didn't make it. They feel they've been told that the Democratic Party is rigged and so forth. I don't know that that's going to last in a general campaign against Bernie, a general campaign against Donald Trump. A lot of that, though, depends on what Sanders does. If Sanders wants to, go all out and try to transform the Democratic Party or take over the Democratic Party, well, then the Democrats have real problems. But it's not clear to me that that's what he's up to.
Well, but the Democrats have real problems, as the president himself has said. They almost have a genetic problem. They only vote in presidential elections and not in midterms. And if they don't, first of all, whoever becomes president may end up in the same gridlock that Obama has been stuck with if they don't take the Senate, the Dems, and obviously the Republicans are worried about down-ticket damage caused by Trump. But at the end of the day, unless they get their act together and figure out how to win midterms like Republicans do, we're going to have gridlock, aren't we?
Well, we could do, but that's a ways away.
I know, one election at a time.
One election at a time. And look, the fact is, if the Democrats can take back the Senate this time, which is a very strong possibility with a Trump candidacy, then the Supreme Court looks much more liberal than it's done for the last 30 years, right? That changes things dramatically right there. That's why this election is so important. I mean, we have all this stuff that's going on, but long before we knew who the candidates were, this was looming as the most important election of your and my lifetime, and we're pretty old. This on this election depends the future of the Supreme Court right away. But more than that, it could go in one direction or another. The country's going to go in one direction or another. The Republicans, if they win the White House, will have control of every level of government, from the state government to the very top, the entire federal government. That's an extraordinary possibility. If a Democrat wins, even if it weren't Hillary Clinton, if the Democrats win, can take back the Senate, get the Supreme Court, then things look very, very different. So we're at a crossroads. And that's, I think, something that's going to have to become more apparent to all of the voters, just what a crossroads we're in, just how it's going to go one way or another way. It's the House divided. It's like 1858. We're getting back to the 1850s. When Abraham Lincoln said we were at a House divided over slavery, well, now we're at a House divided over all the progressive reforms ever since the New Deal. That is what is up for, that is what is up for grabs here, and the civil rights movement. That is what is up for grabs here. We're going to go one way or the other. That's what this election is going to be about, and it's going to become more apparent as we move along.
Well, but it's even more grave than that, surely, with a candidate like Donald Trump. I don't think in American history we've ever had the kind of personality defected, kind of egomaniacal kind of person who he doesn't believe in all of the important things that challenge both the country and the planet, like global warming. He's against almost everything, like Wall Street reform, gun control, a living wage, you name it, all down the list. This is reckless reactionaryism. It's not even coherent reactionaryism.
It simply compounds what I was saying, though. It makes everything I'm saying, you put it up another quantum leap, right? The fact was the election was going to be crucial. Even if John Kasich had been running for the Republicans, it was going to be one or the other. The fact that Donald Trump is going to be the candidate makes it all the more profound, all the more important. I think the country is going to is going to wake up to that fact, going to see how important the election is, see who the two candidates are, and make their choice. But it's going to have to galvanize everyone. We're all in this together. And we're going to have to decide whether not only is it just Donald Trump, the racist wacko that he is and narcissist that he is, but the entire country will be led in the direction, quite apart from his, that will be profoundly, profoundly different than anything we've seen before.
So just in closing then, Sean Wilentz, do you think the public are going to wake up on their own, or does it require a good campaign and a good leader of the opposition with a coherent message to galvanize the people, as you say they have to be?
Absolutely. I mean, the challenge to the Clinton campaign, the enormity of what it's up, puts a lot of weight on them. They have to really come through. The Clinton campaign has to do a better job, I think, than they've done so far. I think that they have to really inspire people. She has to emerge as the kind of leader, get through all of this crazy stuff that the Republicans have been throwing at her about emails and so forth, get through all of that and convince people that she is the person to lead them in this other direction. I think she can. I think she will. I hope for the country that she does.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Sean Wilentz.
My pleasure, Ian, as ever.
Thank you again. And I've been speaking with Sean Wilentz, who is a professor of American history at Princeton University. He's the author of The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008. And his latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. And he has an article at The New York Times, If Trump Breaks Up the GOP, It Won't Be the First. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the assassination by drone of the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Mansour. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christine Fares, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program who specializes in South Asian security issues. Her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fares.
Thank you again for having me.
And obviously there's a certain amount of dancing in the end zone, I guess, in sense of killing the leader of the Taliban. But I don't think there's too many people, even in the security world, and I believe this was an operation by JSOC, the Special Operations Command. So people are sort of a little bit concerned that maybe this is a bit like whack-a-mole. You kill these guys and there's a guy waiting in the wing. It's like the number two guy in Al-Qaeda. They keep finding another number two.
Well, actually, in this case, there really isn't an obvious number two. What we've seen after the announcement that Mullah Omar, in fact, had been dead for at least 2 years, he had died in Pakistan, and that this particular fellow, Mullah Mansour Akhtar, had been issuing press releases in the name of Mullah Omar. What we saw was that there was a lot of reticence to accept Mullah Mansour Akhtar's leadership. There was a lot of anger that he had been pretending to be Mullah Omar, that he had been part of the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, part of their ruse to keep the idea that Mullah Omar was alive. So actually, I think many of us that follow this, we expect that the demise of Mullah Mansour Akhtar is actually going to result in more factionalization of the Taliban at some level. But then at the same time, the Haqqani network, which is the network that the U.S. government has declared to be a foreign terrorist organization, is going to be able to strengthen its hold on parts of the Taliban. So on balance, it's not clear that this is going to be a net gain. And it raises the interesting question of why we didn't do this 10 years ago. When, in fact, getting rid of Mullah Omar would have had more significant battlefield effects than simply removing this fellow so late in the game.
So in terms of factionalism, there's been, I believe, a long struggle. And the fact that Mullah Omar had been dead for 2 years before anybody found out. Apparently, Mansour clashed with Abdelkaim Zakir, the senior military commander, in a power struggle over negotiations with the Afghan government. And I believe he's also had clashes with a splinter group of the Taliban under Mullah Muhammad Rasool, who's challenged his leadership. And there's also this other challenge from the local, well, not just the Haqqanis, but also the local franchise of the Islamic State.
Oh, well, so actually that's a really interesting point. So what had actually been happening for a number of years is that local commanders in Afghanistan that were growing increasingly frustrated with the degree to which Pakistan's intelligence operated command and control over the Taliban, they had come to view Pakistan as just as much the enemy as the United States was. And so they were using the guise of the Islamic State to rebrand themselves, allowing themselves to still operate as violent entrepreneurs, but distinct from the leadership of the Afghan Taliban and beyond the control of the ISI. We really don't know whether or not these ISIS commanders in Afghanistan take their leadership calls directly from al-Baghdadi. That remains a huge question mark. So anyone who spent time in South Asia will see there's the Karachi Fried Chicken operating under the name of KFC. So it's a little bit like, is it the Kentucky Fried Chicken or is it Karachi Fried Chicken? At some point, it doesn't really matter because what they're doing is that they're using this as an opportunity to break away from the mainline structure of the Afghan Taliban and the control that Pakistan exhibits over that organization or the collective of commanders in that organization.
And again,
Incidentally, this plays itself out in a parallel way with respect to the Pakistan Taliban. As long as Mullah Omar was alive, these militant groups that all share an ideological orientation under the Muslim interpretive tradition known as Deobandism, as long as Mullah Omar was alive, there was a considerable amount of pressure for these different Dale Bundy groups, of which the Pakistan Taliban and the Afghan Taliban are a member, to remain loyal to the Mullah Omar Zawahiri dyad. Well, with the succession following Mullah Omar's death and the controversy around Mullah Mansour Akhtar, many of the Pakistan Taliban commanders also defected to ISIS. So I suspect that we're also going to see much more defection of Pakistan Taliban commanders to ISIS as well.
So what are we to make that this drone strike that killed the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Mansour, took place in the Dalbandi area of Balochistan, which is about as remote as you can get in Pakistan? I believe that's where their nuclear test site is. So how much does the Pakistan military and the ISI keep an eye on that area?
So I think there's a couple of things. So this is the first drone strike that's taken place in Balochistan. The Taliban's leadership, most of significant Taliban leadership is in Pakistan's Balochistan. The vast majority, in fact, all but this one, and maybe one other that took place right outside of the federally administered tribal areas. But the federally administered tribal areas have been where all but one and now this drone strike have taken place. And the one drone strike that was previously exception literally took place right adjacent to the tribal areas. So this is notable for a couple of reasons. One, this was not a CIA strike, as you noted. And two, this took place in Balochistan, which has heretofore been off limits. And this raises a number of interesting questions. One, Pakistan does control the airspace, at least in principle. The particular place, Emad Wali, where this drone strike took place, is not too far away from Chagai, which is where Pakistan tested its nuclear weapons in 1998. So you really could not imagine that the ISI, which is Pakistan's intelligence agency, would have been too thrilled that the Americans were able to execute drone flights in this area without Pakistani permission. But it also seems quite odd that the Americans would have killed Mullah Mansour Akhtar with Pakistan's permission. After all, the Pakistanis had been protecting Mullah Mansour Akhtar for about 2 years and trying to suppress the news that Mullah Omar had in fact died. In fact, we only came to know of Mullah Omar's death because of Afghan intelligence linked it, had leaked it. So there's a lot of questions about this. Was the Pakistani state complicit? I'm thinking it probably wasn't. And here's the other thing that's really puzzling from the point of view of U.S. strategy. Eliminating Mullah Mansour Akhtar, ostensibly because he had been a main opponent of Taliban reconciliation efforts in Afghanistan, seems to be very short-sighted because this is going to result in more factionalization, not less. And two, of those elements that are going to remain loyal to the ISI, we will essentially be strengthening the ISI's hand and allowing those elements to come under the greater control of the Haqqani network, which not even 3 years ago, under Secretary Clinton, the United States designated to be a foreign terrorist network. So what exactly is our strategy? Do we think it's going to behoove us to have the Taliban ever more under the control of the Haqqanis? I mean, it's really hard to understand what the end game here is strategically, unless this really was a tactical hit, meaning that, as DOD press releases have suggested, that there was an imminent threat posed by him to U.S. operations in Afghanistan. But it certainly leaves to question what the big game is that the Americans are playing with the assassination of Mullah Mansour Akhtar.
So should we make anything from the fact that the government in Islamabad has not really condemned it or responded in any way? And Pakistan's media, which we know is in many ways in the pocket of the intelligence service, the ISI, they've not rushed to condemn the U.S. As a breach of Pakistan's sovereignty, this strike being a breach of Pakistan's sovereignty.
Well, it's a little bit hard to say because even when the United States killed Osama bin Laden, I was actually in Pakistan the week that he was killed. And actually what was really stunning in Pakistan more than anything was abject radio silence. Initially, there were ambassadors throughout, Pakistani ambassadors throughout the world that applauded the attack. And as the Pakistani state got its act together, within about 5 days, we saw that the narrative that had been agreed upon was that this was a grotesque violation of our sovereignty, that this sort of thing will not be tolerated, et cetera, and so forth. So I would not, that they are being silent is not necessarily a sign that they acquiesce. In fact, there have been a number of attacks where the Pakistanis have howled and squealed, when in fact we eliminated people that were very much a threat to the Pakistani state. Mullah Mansour Akhtar is not a threat to them. They're very much a threat to us, depending on how you define threat. So I'm not going to take their silence as meaning anything per se. I just think it's too early to tell whether or not the Pakistanis collaborated or not. And it is kind of odd that if they did collaborate, what it means is they had seriously misjudged, because they really protected him for more than 2 years after Mullah Omar's death to sort of keep him in the driver's seat. So I feel it's just a little bit too early to speculate about the role that the Pakistanis played.
But the one thing that's clear, and particularly from this conversation, Chris Fair, is that the ISI and the Pakistanis play us like a violin. I mean, they seem to have always be one or two steps ahead of us, and they control all of these assets, the Haqqanis, the Taliban, etc.
Are you still there? Because I can't hear you.
Pardon? Can you not hear me? Hello? I think I lost Chris. Can you call her back quickly? Again, are you there, Chris? No. Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program, who specializes in South Asian security issues. Her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And we're trying to get her back on the phone. Are you there, Chris?
Oh, yeah. That was kind of odd.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Well, maybe the ISI are censoring us here. But I was
exactly
making the point that, Pakistan ISI always seems to be one or two steps ahead of us. They control all of these assets, like the Haqqani network. They sheltered bin Laden, obviously, and they have protected Mullah Mansour, as you've pointed out. So let's then not so much look at American strategy, which you've pointed out may well be incoherent. What do you think is Pakistan's strategy, or the ISI strategy, since, as the old joke goes, Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country?
Yeah, so I mean, my sense has been, actually for the last several months, the Haqqani network has been strengthening their ties over the Taliban. And the Haqqani network, I think in the recent years, particularly after Mullah Omar's death, have demonstrated to the Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI, that it is in fact the most reliable militia in Afghanistan. So I would not be surprised if the Pakistanis have, basically sacrificed Mullah Mansour Akhtar, quite frankly, to basically toss the rump of the Taliban into the control of Haqqanis. Now, this is a little bit interesting because, as you likely know, the U.S. government has held a large sum of reimbursements known as coalition support funds for the Pakistanis, because we didn't feel that the Pakistanis, in fact, it's kind of an empirical truth, not even a sense, that the Pakistanis were not only doing an inadequate job in countering the Haqqani network, but that, in fact, they were actively aiding and abetting them. So it would be truly a bizarre demonstration of U.S. power if we eliminated that one person that would allow the Taliban to become ever more aligned with Haqqani, when we are actually pressing the Pakistanis to do more against the Haqqani network. But I do think that that's kind of where the Pakistanis want to go. They trust the Haqqanis, the quarreling commanders within the Taliban raise a lot of questions. Many of them hate the Pakistanis as much as they hate us. But the Haqqanis have been a very reliable proxy. It's through, for example, the Haqqani network that the Pakistanis have been able to order attacks on the U.S. embassy, NATO headquarters, as well as the Indian embassy in various conflicts in Afghanistan. So I mean, it really just goes to show you how out of sync American and Pakistani interests and objectives are in Afghanistan.
Well, would given the animus between the Taliban, at least a lot of Taliban commanders, and their sense that that they hate the Pakistanis almost as much as the Americans. Is that something that the government in Kabul could work with? I mean, is there any way, if this is the ultimate aim of the Pakistanis, to turn the Haqqanis into their proxy and have them dominate the country, is there any possibility of some kind of, not an alliance, but some kind of modus vivendi between the Taliban and the government in Kabul?
I don't think so, because even the factions that can't stand the Pakistanis are not terribly huge fans of the Afghan government. I think what we're going to just see is more competition amongst the commanders, as well as defection to ISIS, because that really seems to be the alternative to an ISI-dominated Taliban, is basically rebranding yourself as being an ISIS affiliate.
Well, that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, that ISIS is you know, metastasizing after all of this effort to degrade and destroy them, as President Obama said. They are actually increasing their franchises. They may not be doing that as well as they were in Iraq and Syria, but they're certainly exporting this particular brand, which is, I think,
see,
it's... Go ahead.
I don't really see it that way. I mean, we don't actually have evidence that these commanders in Afghanistan calling themselves ISIS actually have command and control relationships with al-Baghdadi. It is a brand, for sure, and so to the extent that this gives ISIS a fillip, these guys are not actually conducting high-value attacks in the name of ISIS. Now, compare this to, for example, what's happening in Bangladesh. Bangladesh has had a series of really atrocious, savage assassinations of cultural critics who tend to be more liberal, and they are perpetrating these attacks in the name of ISIS. We haven't really seen this. What we are seeing is that commanders are taking control of local areas in Afghanistan under the name of ISIS. And that's a very different phenomenon on the name. And then there is still also a very active competition between al-Qaeda, Indian subcontinent, which was launched a few years ago in effort to retain the al-Qaeda brand in South Asia. They are still also actively contesting in Afghanistan. About a year ago, there was a large AQIS camp that NATO ISAF, well, no longer operating the ISAF name, but which NATO forces had raided and broken up in Kandahar, and it had a huge collective of international fighters. So it's really a four-way contest, really, between the Afghans and their international partners, various parts of the Taliban arrayed under Haqqani and so forth, al-Qaeda, Indian subcontinent, as well as ISIS.
I'm afraid we're over time, so I thank you so much for joining us. And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program who specializes in South Asian security issues. Her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.